Okay, now back to part two. I forgot to tell you when we were on part one that when I came to KLRB this evening, there was a telephone call from a woman who read the article, the San Jose Mercury, that I believed Hitler was alive, that different sources had told me that he was alive. And the article mentioned KLRB and Carmel, so she called here. And she gave me her name, and she asked me, do you really think Adolf Hitler is alive? And I spoke with her on the telephone, and I gave her the reasons why I believed it, and the information that I was told, and that I didn't take it lightly, that it was highly possible, and particularly since the new evidence of Eva Braun not having died in the bunker, and we were told she died, and Martin Bormann being dead in Germany, and now we find out he's alive. And Hitler so carefully planned the last 2 years of his life that there's no reason why he couldn't be alive. And I told her about his birthday party in Brazil and the sources of information I had on that subject. Well, she gave me her name, and she talked about her uncle, and she told me that her uncle is Adolf Hitler, and that's why she wondered, that she's his niece, and that I'm going to get in touch with her. She gave me her maiden name, her first husband's name, and then the second. She lives up in the San Jose area, and she has pictures of herself. Her mother was a sister of Hitler's mother, and she has pictures with Adolf in 1928. That's the last time she saw him. She's lived in Chicago from 1922 until just last year, and she told me about her uncle. She called him Uncle Dolly. I guess that's for Adolf. That was Uncle Dolly. And this is his niece, and she was interested in what I had to say. She wasn't surprised, and so I'll get in touch with her. I'd like to see the pictures, and she was interested to know if she could possibly find him if he is alive. And I thought that that was an interesting telephone call. You know, if you take information and you do research, you put it in the in the category of possible or impossible, and where do the sources of information come from, and you put it aside in folders and think about it and throw it out to new people investigating the same thing, and hopefully get information from other people. If you think it's impossible, or if you believe every single thing you read, you never can come to the answer of some of these questions. There were devils in many instances throughout history, current modern history. And as I say, this was so carefully planned and written about so many times about his survival and my access to people who told me stories about it that I believed that it was possible. So I'll talk to this woman. Her first name is Josephine. And we'll talk about Uncle Dolly. And hopefully I'll get to see the pictures of her when she was little with him and maybe learn more about him. I'm sure she knows plenty about Uncle Dolly. Now, the Time magazine, March 29th, 1982, just last week, speaking of Uncle Dolly, had the review of a book that I mentioned. I mentioned the play that opened in London that was so controversial. The play is called The Portage to San Cristobal of A.H., San Cristobal, down South America. Pardon me, A.H., Adolf Hitler. And this is a book that was written. I thought it was just a play that was being produced in London. It's taken from a book by George Steiner, and the adaptation of the book is by Christopher Hampton. He was doing the play in London. It caused such a consternation, and the idea in the play is that Adolf Hitler was found in Brazil, and that the people there who closed in on him realized that they never could get a hearing or a trial, so they gave him a trial in the jungle to hear what Adolf Hitler had to say. And the last 20 minutes of the play are supposed to be defense of Hitler, actually challenging what he thought in his mind he was doing. Then it's up to you, the audience, or the person to come up with something better and think about it, because the idea is still alive. Time magazine, March 29th, 1982, has a book review of The Portage to San Cristobal of A.H. by George Steiner. It's published by Simon & Schuster. the lead article in the book review is Teaching the Grammar of Hell. The idea asked in this review or in the book that is thrown out to people is, what would happen if the Jewish Avengers such as Simon Wiesenthal, good luck, were really to find Hitler? As I say, Martin Bormann and Eva Braun and others are alive or left Germany well and alive. Hitler would, he was born in 1889 and allegedly died April the 30th, 1945. He has an anniversary of his birth and death this month. And the book is about the great powers of Europe who really don't want to find him. And this is, in fact, true of Martin Bormann, Joseph Mengele, and many of the Nazis living in South America. And they said that Paris doesn't want Hitler because they'd be embarrassed to expose the role of the Vichy government in going along with Adolf Hitler and selling out France. The Germans don't want him because the government now is filled with people who worked with Adolf Hitler, and they don't want jurisdiction over him. America decides that they'll send in somebody to interview him, and they send in a television crew, which is syndicated, and they turn out to be from the CIA. Wouldn't you know? So the play and the book are about the idea of language, the use of language. How do you arouse people? How do you speak to create something good? How do you speak to destroy something good? And the hypnotic trance that Hitler had in his use of words, how he turns them around to his own use, and how the intelligence agencies would like to silence him and either pick him up and silence him, kidnap him, or sell him and make a package out of him to sell. I guess we'd have Adolf Hitler t-shirts and Adolf Hitler bookmarks and roller skates and lunchboxes, okay? So his long 20-minute defense of himself is the last word in the play, and that's it. Now, this George Steiner, who wrote it, was a refugee from Hitler. He lived in France, and he said that he grew up in New York and saw a picture of Adolf Hitler looking like a beggar, and nobody was listening to him. And then 10,000 people were listening, and then 1 million people were listening. And that the language of Hitler got people aroused so that later it was millions. And this book that goes into the problem of recreating the things that Hitler did to get the people around him. And he says that he's very concerned for his own family, his own children. He said that Hitler could not have done what he did without everybody else. And this is absolutely true. And I'm not talking about Gentiles or racists or the Falwells or the far right. I'm talking about the Jews. The Jews allow Hitler and put him where he was. The Germans allowed it, and the Germans saw in him what they liked about their history. And this author said, I'm very involved in the idea that those who were destined to be at the highest level of intellect were going down to the bottom of mankind, and I'm trying to teach my children the sense of vulnerability and keep them in training for survival. Now, it's awfully hard to train your children or my children for survival if they don't want the training. You can only tell them what's happening, and it's so abhorrent that they pull away and hate you for it sometimes. Some hate you, some like you, but they are very threatened by the choice of having to do something, of speaking up, of being different. It's an interesting idea, the play. What would you do if he were here? That he is located in Brazil, how would you react when you see him, and who wants him, and what role does his words have that could repeat again to arouse the kind of excitement that people had in him? I think his total abandon of everything except what he wanted at a time where there wasn't any way to handle this huge threat of communism and the monarchies wanting to be back on the throne, and the bankers being afraid that they'd lose their money if socialism took over. Everybody was so threatened of losing money and investments in the empire, the British Empire, and the French expansion, and the Spaniards in South America. What if everybody took control of the means of production for themselves and for their own health system and for their own education? there would never be that super high elite to dictate that would make them separate from the masses. And it's very hard to visualize yourself separate from the masses. There was an Archie Bunker scene this evening where he had some Puerto Rican family of the woman that he liked over for dinner, and she was so disgusted, and she said, just try to go out every day and look at people and think of them as equal to you, that you're not better, but that they're all equal. And Archie Bunker said, well, I can do it one by one, but not all those people out there. There's no way that I can give up that idea. So the subject of Adolf is not going to fade away. I was writing about it 10 years ago in my taxes. I bring it up every week. And I think until the writers and the thinkers of this country, the people who oppose weapon systems and wars and beheadings and mutilations and the kinds of things that are going on, until people figure out where it originated and how the strength of it came through allowing those people who tortured, who experimented, whether it was in Japan during the war, in Germany, or in South America today, or Central America, with the sterilization of people in California and our mental hospitals and prisons, until we begin to change our way, the way we look at these things, we are going to have to go back to the formation of Hitler and the Nazis, who very nicely can dispose of these masses once they get in control again. I don't think people realize what formidable person this was, or the brilliance of his organization. It was just in April in 1940 that Hitler attacked Denmark and Norway, and in Belgium right after that, and then Holland. And he went to Holland in 1940 and said, would you give up and become German? And he hadn't since 1795, or a time period like that. And they were ready to surrender and say, yes, we'll be German. And he was going to bomb Rotterdam, and they said, okay, we'll be German. So he decided he'd bomb it anyway the next day, and 175,000 people were out of homes. And then he began to shift another 150,000 to Germany in slave labor camps. He said, become German, and we won't do it. And then he had the total power and did it anyway. And nothing impressed the people so much, I guess, as that strength. So he just took all of Europe, Eastern Europe and Western Europe, and could go through and control these people. And this had been very carefully planned. Now, are there plans that careful to take the United States piece by piece, and has it been operating for 40 years? Yeah, I think it has, and I think it's working, and I think every article that I read fits into the intent. The intent was there before, it worked, so why not try it one more time? Speaking of Richard Nixon and Watergate and the 1972 era where I didn't want to pay my taxes, that was the month before, or get the refund rather, the month before Watergate, there were several articles about poor Richard Nixon and his library. It's sort of a traveling library. It should be books on wheels. They tried to get it into Independence, Missouri. You might have read that. And some people in Independence were just horrified to think that they would try to pull the Nixon library next to the Harry Truman library. An article in the Washington Post said, despite Truman's remark that he didn't think Nixon even knew how to tell the truth, the librarian there, or the city officials, said they believed the late president would have welcomed the Nixon papers. But other people said to have it a half a mile from Harry Truman's home is horrendous. The Truman Library is in Independence, Missouri, and to put the Nixon Library a half a mile from there is horrendous. Well, I look back now, and I don't think there's that much difference between them. Harry had the atomic bomb. Harry allowed Alan Dulles and the Nazis to come to this country, Reinhard Gehlen, 1945 to 47, to form the CIA. When he was out of office, he said he had created an American Gestapo, but he let Herbert Hoover and the powers that be from Germany come to this country and make it. He knew where the war criminals were or weren't, and he knew about Project Paperclip and the importation of Nazi war criminals into every state that we have here, and the modeling of the CIA after the German Gestapo. So Harry Truman gave the permission to drop the atomic bombs, and he allowed the National Security Council to be formed, and the a national security advisor in the CIA. So I think it's kind of fitting that we put Nixon and Truman next to each other. I really don't think that's so bad. But a few days after that article, there was one from the LA Times and from the AP wire service you probably saw. April 1st, Leavenworth may be the Nixon library home. Now, that's really cute. That's getting closer. See, many of you are too young to remember who listens to this program that Leavenworth, Kansas was always the home of the prison. And when we used to talk about Leavenworth years ago when I was growing up, we talked about Alcatraz and Leavenworth. Those were the two most notorious prisons in the United States. So Crook Nixon may end up at Leavenworth. After all, he didn't go to jail for the Watergate, but the presidential in library in Leavenworth would be pretty neat. That's where it belongs, and maybe that's where it'll go. There was a St. Patrick's Day party, a gay crowd at the White House. Maybe you saw the Washington Post. There was a picture of Ronnie. Top of the afternoon, they had a little party list, St. Patrick's Day parade, and they met the Irish Prime Minister, and I'm sure you'd love the guest list. I won't read everyone who was there. They had a luncheon with George Bush and various people, some of them that were interesting. What I saw was J. Peter Grace, chairman of W.R. Grace. That's the fellow who was appointed by Ronald Reagan for this new committee with deciding on cutting down domestic expenses, which is really reducing to slave labor. He's the partner with Otto Ambrose, the Nazi war criminal. Peter Daly, U.S. ambassador to Ireland, naturally. Senator Edward Kennedy was there with Mr. Grace. And Senator Paul Axalt, the guy from Las Vegas, Nevada, with his interweaving mobster connections and finance campaign manager for Ronald Reagan. There was John Lehman Jr., Secretary of the Navy, and Barbara Lehman. That's the host of the Sans Pantaloon parties in earlier days, or maybe present time. Edwin Meese, the presidential counselor. Jeremiah O'Leary, who's become the assistant to William Clark. Jeremiah O'Leary was from the Washington Star, the paper that went broke, but he was the pathological liar newsman who covered the House Select Committee on Assassinations for Public Broadcasting. I called O'Leary once and told him he should be hung by the heels like Mussolini for being such a pathological liar about what was really happening and about the evidence to kill Robert Kennedy, John Kennedy rather, and how he was covering it up. And carrying on a dialogue of the testimony continuously on public radio that didn't relate to what was really happening in the room, and when important things happened, they were covered up, and the unimportant lies were given the full coverage. And, of course, there was William Casey of the CIA there at the party. William Casey is the fellow that worked with Reinhard Gehlen, Hitler's intelligence chief, and Lucky Luciano, and worked his way up to the director of the CIA with Vice President George Bush, and William Clark, the new assistant to the president. He's the National Security Affairs Advisor. I guess he came to the luncheon after meeting with Mr. Schmitz, who said that Israel should be liquidated. He went to see his friend Clark, the man who's running for Senate from California. He went to Washington to see him before he went off to see the PLO and the Saudi Arabians. He thinks the state of Israel should be dismantled, and William Clark from California is one of his good friends. The party, of course, is a who's who and what's what of all kinds of interesting names. I won't go down all of them, but I love the meeting of Senator Ted Kennedy in among all the thieves and assassins who killed both of his brothers. I mean, the guy doesn't blush about anything. I mean, he would go anywhere at any time, I suppose. I mean, I guess, is that how you stay in the Senate or get in the first place, or if you want to run for president? But I certainly wouldn't sit down with that mess of people, and I would have more dignity and stay away and tell them why I stayed away. But Senator Ted Kennedy isn't known for his great dignity. Another article in the Los Angeles Times this week. Ex-cop seeks order in the courts. Oh, boy. Now get ready. J.D. Smith, a cop who started his Los Angeles Police Department career, he had an incident that made him famous at the police academy graduation, a conservative law and order proponent, has been appointed a judge by California's liberal governor, Edmund Brown Jr. Now, he has now gone over the brink. Last week, our liberal Jesuit priest governor said, we have to have the B-1 bombers. I mentioned this before on the radio because it's good for business and contracts in California. Now he has chosen a member of the Los Angeles Police Department to be a judge. And interestingly enough, it says Chief Daryl Gates said, this is the first time I've been proud of the governor of the state. And he suggests that he may be actually maturing. See, Brown has to get ripe enough to run for other offices. You can't just be governor in California. So in order to do that, he has to put a member of the Los Angeles Police Department, one of the most notorious police departments in the country, emulated after, as Lewis Tacwood said, the Gestapo. He has to put him as a judge to make decisions in California and down there, maybe, where the cases from the LAPD will come. I'm going next week to discuss the new appointment of a police chief in Carmel, California, who was with the Los Angeles Police Department and with Ed Davis and Evel Younger. It's very threatening to me personally because of the work I've done to try and expose the Los Angeles Police Department. So when they had interviews of 30 or 40 people and they brought one in to Carmel, a very quiet town without too many problems, and you bring in a member of the LAPD where they're notorious for counterintelligence, racism, and various activities, working closely with people like Jim Jones and Ronald Reagan and the White House, the Squad 19 and the counterintelligence agents such as Lewis Tacwood. When a man like that comes to Carmel, I feel threatened because if there were a crime or somebody did something to me, I've been exposing the police department that he's worked with for many years. So I'll talk about the new appointment here in Carmel. But this fellow now has been appointed as a judge. And the newspaper said, Los Angeles Times said, precisely how Reagan Republican J.D. Smith managed to be appointed by Reagan critic Brown is a matter of no small speculation. Some have suggested it serves the governor's expanding political interests, you better believe that, to appoint a few tough and law and order types. Others have noted that since Smith served as Gates' liaison officer to the judiciary, he knew virtually every judge in California and in this community, in the county and the judges. So you see, the police department has a liaison officer to every judge, and you wonder how the courts get ever overturned or how the LAPD destruction of evidence, such as cutting off the coat of Robert Kennedy in Los Angeles when he was murdered, or the ceiling panels for the Ambassador Hotel destroyed, or the scandalous behavior of Thomas Noguchi that never is resolved. The police department has a liaison to the judges, and the judges decide which way these cases go. So it's very dangerous if the police department is in counterintelligence and is advising the judges, and then now a policeman is on the court as a judge. So we have Ed Davis of the Los Angeles Police Department in the Senate of California. We have a policeman from the LAPD, a judge in California, and Evel Younger is still hiding, waiting for a big appointment. I don't know when he'll surface or why he's quiet for so long, but he will surface. I did see him when I was in Los Angeles the last trip, just before this one, and he was at the country club where my folks were, and came up and gives my father a big hug. He was really drunk, or I thought he was drunk, or let's say inebriated, in case he wants to challenge me on that one. If ever he would, I'd say he had one or two. If anyone saw him, there are a lot of people out there, you would agree, and I was just hoping that someone would follow him like they do Johnny Carson and some of these other people, because I thought he was smashed, and it would have been very nice to see Evel Younger over there on Pico or Olympic, leaving filled with a lot of good liquor. But he's in the hiding, he's waiting, but now one of the LAPD people is working his way up, and he'll be a judge appointed, a Reaganite judge from the LAPD appointed by Jerry Brown. Another way the LAPD is interfering into cases is that Mr. Vandekamp, the district attorney down there, wants to throw out the idea that you can't hypnotize a person on trial to recall their memory. Now, this is very controversial, and it will work several ways to the advantage of the police department to, if they hypnotize a person, they can tell them that they did the crime when they didn't, such as Sirhan Sirhan, who's told how he murdered Robert Kennedy in the place of Thane Caesar. The courts now say you can't use hypnosis, but then again, they can use that to throw out some of the mass murderers that have worked with the Los Angeles Police Department in the past, so that they can get their mass murderers kicked out. Even the Manson type that worked with the police department, if hypnosis was used, or they're begging to get the hypnosis back because it's very instrumental in getting a patsy. If you use hypnosis in a criminal case, you can get a selected patsy, and he won't know what happened or why he was there and can't remember anything, probably for the rest of his life. Hypnosis is a tricky thing used in court because you can make a person be told he did a crime and he can serve for somebody else when he didn't really do it. You can hypnotize a person to get on an airplane. This actually happened by his best friend, and put a bomb on the plane and give him another name. And then this fellow collected the insurance and was picked up at his wife's home in Texas. This was about 12 years ago. If you want to reprogram them or deprogram them, there comes the element of other people interfering with the planned selected patsy. Hypnosis is a tricky thing. It is used in California. I don't know how much your other states carry it or use it, but it's tricky. And they tried to pass a law that you can't use hypnosis anymore to nail a witness. But Mr. Vandekamp wants to reverse that and use hypnosis. And these controversial mass killers, I am convinced, were involved in a kind of hypnosis program. And I don't know the way the legislation will go or whether it will be applied to specific cases to let them out, because that was the deal they were promised anyway. But I think that the best way to judge whether hypnosis is used in a case is go to all the physical evidence first and see how it lines up. In other words, say if Robert Kennedy is murdered, and he was, and if the bullet holes come in back of them, and they did, and if the fatal bullet came in back of his head, then you should be allowed, if the ceiling panels are removed, to show the trajectory from the bottom up. If a man was seen pulling a gun an inch from in back of his head, a security guard who fell to the ground after the sleeve is cut off and the shirt is cut off, when all that information indicates that the assassin was standing behind Senator Robert Kennedy in Los Angeles, again with the Los Angeles Police Department, then hypnosis should be used to find out who Sirhan Sirhan really is. Of course, the court steps in and stops that, and Sirhan is begged to go back to the ambassador to see if he can recall anything, because he can't remember anything. It's a very controversial subject, I know. Well, our time is up now. I hope that you didn't pay too many taxes. Maybe you'll have the nerve to send in a letter like I did 10 years ago. I sent that in 10 years ago. I don't know how I had the nerve. I look back now. I don't know how I had the nerve to send it into the Treasury Department, because there was G. Gordon Liddy and Mr. Caulfield and the whole gang. But I guess ignorance is bliss, and I meant what I said. The facts were true, and I knew there were monsters there, and later, a month or two later, they were identified. But that's the way it goes, and this year I'll just send what I have to without any messages, and I guess my message comes out once a week on KLRB, and we'll suffice it with that, because I'm not going to reason with those people anyway, so we'll just share it with each other. In the meantime, take care of yourself. I'll try to get rid of this cold and the scratchy voice, and I'll be back with you next week. This is Mae Brussel in Carmel, California.
This has been World Watchers International with noted conspiracy investigator Mae Brussel. This program originates from Carmel, California.
At KLRB, Carmel.